Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Boys, we are housebound this week, at least Pipe and I are, because of a blizzard that that happened here in the South. And by a blizzard, I mean about 3 to 5 inches, which is debilitating for people down here. So, Pipe, we've barely been out of our houses. Ronald, I don't know how it is in Ohio. Are you guys dealing with the same thing up there?
Yeah, we got the big, we definitely got the big storm night before last, about, 6 or 7 inches, but
okay,
it kind of stopped and all the roads get cleared pretty quick here. So everybody's pretty functional.
Oh yeah, man. Upper Midwest, you guys are on it.
Yeah. Ted, do you remember what it's like to live in a place where snow plows and salt trucks are, you know, available?
Dude, I do. We have like one salt truck in all of Jackson, Tennessee, I think. And it gets worked around the clock. But yeah, that was something. But I'll say this, Pipe. I'm so glad to not live in that kind of climate anymore. because it was slowly killing my soul, I think. So
I think the basic premise is whatever climate you live in, you gripe about it and find the benefits in the one you don't live in, you know, unless you're in Southern California, in which case you have nothing to complain about. But
except the government's intrusion on your life, but
yeah. And mudslides and wildfires and
that's,
you know,
true.
Generally being on the earthquakes. Brink of death.
Yeah. 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 For sure.
But
for sure.
Yeah. I gripe about the lack of snow trucks. And then I realize I gripe about it once every 3 years. Cause that's about how often it snows here. So probably not
exactly.
Worth complaining.
There you go.
Exactly.
There you go, boys.
Bring folks,
some,
this has been
bringing some reason been to the program.
Three old men chatting about the weather. Until next time.
Yeah.
No. Far be it from us, boys, to end it so quickly. Piper, you have business to conduct because we have sponsors to promote. Let's do that now.
Yes, our first sponsor is the Mirror Agency. They are a website development company who actually, they've done my website, which is also the Happy Rant website. But much more prominently, they have also done websites for the Gettys. That would be the music Gettys, Ooh. Not like Gettys and Rothschilds. for Tim Challies, for kind of everything Jared C. has his hands in. So Midwestern, Spurgeon, For the Church. They're the they're the technical wizards behind all of that. They did wonder when they would be able to help Ronnie with Substance Church's website. That was a specific question they asked Ronnie, so a thing to consider.
Well, if he's doing Jared's, I mean, you know,
yeah, I mean,
sense.
I wonder. I bet there's a best friend discount or something. You could,
I bet.
If we only wouldn't have just finished ours like 10 minutes ago, so revamping ours, unfortunately, that time.
Yeah, but
there
see,
you go. Next time.
But websites are never finished products. You always have to be iterating. That's the term. You iterate.
Oh, yeah. New iteration.
Yes.
Right.
I think the struggle with websites these days are, do anybody go to them anymore? You know,
that's well, there's the rub. Yeah.
Do they matter anymore?
Well it's debatable, baby.
They matter if they look terrible. You know what I mean?
That's
so like
true.
You can't, you have to be above a certain threshold. And then above that, it's like, nah, whatever. Which is a great ringing endorsement for Mirror Agency and all of their work because they get you above that, yeah, whatever standpoint. But if your church, your organization is looking for a web redesign, web support, new website, go to mirroragency.com and they have a contact form there. And actually, if you mention the Happy Rant and you end up going with them, you will get a 20% discount off of your monthly fee. So they have a monthly support fee that they charge going forward, as does every web support company. So that's not, specific to them. But so that basically means you get 20% off for the life of it. So any advancements, any whatever, you can actually save more as time goes on. But that 20% kind of goes on in perpetuity. So again, go to mirroragency.com, check out their work. They do really good work. Matt, the guy who founded Mirror, used to work for Desiring God and helped launch their kind of big web presence back in the day before he spun off and started his own thing. He's a wonderful dude. He's a pastor as well, and they're very good at what they do. So check out mirroragency.com. Our second sponsor is Dwell Bible, who you will be familiar with, listeners, unless this is your first time. Dwell is an audio Bible app. If you go to dwellapp.io/happyrant, you'll see the discounts they offer to our listeners. It's 10% off their monthly subscription or 33% off of their lifetime subscription. It's under $100 for access to this forever and ever and ever as they continue to develop and add narrators and add plans. But the thing I want to highlight for them right now is that they have a Lent listening plan. So if you want something to help walk you up to Holy Week and Easter in the coming weeks, download Dwell, subscribe, and then check out that Lent plan. It's a really well laid out thing to help prepare your heart, especially in this crazy time. It's kind of hard to forget that Easter's right around the corner, but it'll walk you up to that. Check out their Lent listening plan. It's a great feature as well. Again, go to dwellapp.io/happyrant and check them out.
Outstanding promo work, Pipe, as always. I love the whole mention the Happy Rant thing at checkout. I always imagine like just two guys casually conversating, and the one guy's like, "Yeah, Happy Rant." And the other guy's like, "Oh, all right, 20% off." I don't know why I'm delighted by that.
It feels a little bit like wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of thing. It's like, psst, like code is Happy Rant.
Yeah. Hey, Happy Rant. Yeah. No, I like that. I like
you
that.
Let I like, into, like the secret in. Back room or something.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like having a speakeasy, you know, minus the
if only
law breaking. Yeah, yeah. Oh, I know it. I know it. If only that would be, that's aspirational for us boys, but before we can get there, we have to do the thing that really puts food on the table for us, and that is this podcast in the way that we typically do it, in as much as we talk about one to three things for about 35 minutes. So, boys, today I thought it would be fun to talk about like weird theologies or weird theological things, weird things that our churches did that we kind of grew up with as kids that are no longer like in play for our churches. This is a great topic. Baby, I think this was your idea. So go ahead and kick us off. What are some of these things?
Oh man, it's funny because it's like you think about church and you think about theology and doctrine, and some of the more, how shall we say, like outlying doctrines tend to be cyclical. You know, is that a word? Cyclical? Is that the right
cyclical?
Word?
Cyclical.
Cyclical. Cyclical.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We got to hear from the prof, right? So I appreciate that.
Wow. Well, I mean, I don't have a doctorate, so, you know.
Well, I don't either, right?
Not so, tenured, well, not but, yet. You know.
Not yet. We're not quite there yet. I'll be telling you guys how to speak here in about 12 months, but...
We can't wait.
It's going to be great.
Let me speak for Pipe and say we're both really excited.
It's going to be fantastic to be correcting you every 10 or so seconds.
Wonderful.
But yeah, so the cycle of all of that, and so I was, I don't know why, when we were talking about what we should talk about, it just kind of kicked in for me. But I was thinking about, some of the spooky kind of eschatology stuff that I grew up with, that it almost seems unbelievable that I would be part of a church that would even be discussing those things. Right. And I know there's still many churches that do. I just haven't been in tribes that sort of like, you know, just get all serious about, you know, end times and having that particular perspective on it. But it was funny to grow up in a place where that was, I mean, that literally framed everything that was said. So it doesn't matter what book of the Bible you were in. It doesn't matter what passage you were preaching. Somehow it got to Mark of the Beast, getting your head chopped off.
That's incredible.
Like, helicopters coming down from the sky that are like, yes, you know, like in the form of a beast. And, just
of course,
things like that.
Yeah. Yeah, didn't they have like scorpion tails on them too? It was like helicopters with scorpion tails.
But like, here's the thing.
They were wearing jackets with scorpions on the back, you know?
Yeah. And like, nobody blinked an eye. So all of this stuff is talked about and everybody's just nodding their heads and they're just like praying to God that although, you know, this moment where we get to like, you know, the Lord finally returns, we get to meet him in the air. Although this is supposed to be like the greatest and expectant hope of the Christian, we're all just like literally like paralyzed with fear, kind of hoping it never happens.
Oh, right? Totally. You're going to meet him in the air by like ejecting out of an F-16 and like going right into like the side door of a helicopter, you know?
Yeah. So it's gonna it's basically what we're thinking is, man, the End Times is gonna be the scariest M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Like, oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Coming into realization. And I mean, I like that. I like that I get to go to heaven, but gosh darn, getting there, does it have to be so gosh darn scary?
Well, absolutely. Yeah, it does. So I have a couple of follow-up questions on that, actually. I'm interested in like how deep they would take it in context where like the sermon is pretty straightforward. So like Christmas and Easter, was there still a little rapture tie-in?
Well, certainly for Easter. I mean, Easter, I feel was an easier pivot. I think it was just like, there was just always this, and again, it wasn't entirely all wrong, right? So they did try to have this expectancy, but it was like, no matter what we were doing, no matter what we were engaged in, it was like, stay awake, be aware, because you could wake up in the morning and, if you're not saved, the kettle that your mom put on the stove is just going to be like, it's just going to be bubbling over, but she's not going to be there. And you've been left behind, the Larry Norman song, right?
So you'll have to pull it off the stove.
You'll have to pull it off the stove.
Covered by DC Talk for a later generation. Let's not forget.
Oh, yeah. Amazing. And so, exactly. So there was just that constant, no matter what it was like, I mean, all this is good. And all this doctrine, all this theology, it's only there because we need to tell people that they need to receive Christ, because the rapture could be coming at any minute, and we have people that are going to hell, and that is primary. And there is something about that is primary. We would agree with that. But everything just somehow funneled back into that reality.
Well, and the subtext was always like, or at least in my church context, it was always like, you don't want to be sinning like at the moment that it happens, you know what I mean?
Like, did you have a list of things that you couldn't be doing when Jesus came back? Like, I think it was my mom was saying that she kind of grew up with that. So like playing cards, movie theaters, you wouldn't want to be caught in a movie theater when Jesus came back.
It's dark in there. And yeah, I mean, who knows?
But that's interesting, isn't it? It's like so that was exactly what was said. Like, would you feel, so this was how they set it up. Would you feel good doing the thing you're doing if Jesus returned? But what was never said was, well, maybe, but like, what are you saying is going to happen if I'm doing the thing I don't feel good about and he returns? There was just sort of this like understood thing that like, well, he may not rapture you.
He's not going to pick you for the team.
He doesn't like the thing you're doing. Yeah.
Well, yeah, totally. If you happen to be like halfway through a hand of solitaire when, when Jesus comes back, like you're probably going to hell, tough deal.
But like, was Monopoly okay? Like, help me.
Yeah,
understand
that's the
which
thing.
Games
it's
are
it's
like,
unclear. It's unclear.
Yeah. Could old ladies play bridge? Is that acceptable? Or are they all being left behind?
They could play bridge, but only if they weren't gossiping while playing bridge.
Oh, okay. So no, I thought gossip was one of the acceptable sins. That's what I gathered from church growing up.
I think it probably is.
That was a safe one. Cards were that, condemned.
Yeah.
But I think what strikes me, and this is what I'd like to hear you guys speak into, is like, we can talk about sort of the ha-ha part of it, which is, there's some absurdities with it, right? But I'm sort of taken in by the general tone of spookiness that was perfectly acceptable about it. Like, it was okay for it to kind of like to come off like some B-level horror movie. and like somehow that was okay.
Are you
and
just thinking
like
of
B-level
a
horror
the
movie
night.
That they made about it?
That had something to do with it, right? Like Thief in the Night.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. For younger listeners, before there was the Left Behind series, there was the Thief in the Night series of movies. What was that, like mid-70s that those came out? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just total, I mean, they were like C quality movies and entirely designed to terrify people about the second coming of Christ. They involved guillotines and machine guns and prison camps and I don't know, like white bathrobes. It was all very weird.
Yeah. I mean, Pipe, it literally looked like basically what the end times were is that Christians were living in communes wearing white robes. And at some point, everybody was coming to chop their heads off. And if they accidentally, because they didn't realize what they're doing, get this like mark, this stamped on their forehead or their hand, there was no going back. There was no going back, and the commune was going to be infiltrated.
Yes.
The guillotines were coming out, and you were going to have a guillotine party on Tuesday.
Yeah, well, I'll never forget, you know, Patty's beheading in those movies. It was a seminal, scarring moment of my sixth grade year. I went to this little Christian school in middle school, and they decided to use those in Bible class during sixth grade. Nice. So we watched all of those. I think Thief in the Night was just one of them. It was a whole series of them. And
the teacher was a little tired, couple of days off.
Yeah. And just, well, yeah. And this is clearly just strong biblical teaching. Yeah. Then there was, I remember a scene where the beasts came and, you know, and they would, you know, their sting was like a scorpion, except so it was like this big shadow on a wall of a scorpion tail, but with like a harpy face. And yeah, just, And this was just totally exciting. And like nobody in my class was like, wait, what are we watching? And my teacher's just feeding this to us as Bible class. It was delightful in retrospect.
Yeah, so I have three cheers for literal interpretation. It's just crazy. Yeah.
Dude, so my follow-up is, at this school, were there parent-teacher conferences?
Yes.
And did John Piper like raise any concerns about the movies? Like, was he like, hey, so Thief in the Night, can we talk about it?
I don't know that my dad ever went to a parent-teacher conference, and that's not to say he was a delinquent dad, because I don't remember my mom going to very many of them either.
Sure.
My parents had the kind of relationship where they talked to teachers if I got far enough out of line, but it wasn't a conference. Yeah. It was like, send this note home to your parents, they're going to sign it, you're going to get a beating, and all will be well.
That's kind of how it was back then.
Yeah.
You know, it's
no, but the year after that, so that was sixth grade, the year after that, our Bible teacher decided we needed to create a visual representation of the end times. So like, what was it? The assignment was, we had to do a timeline of the end times, you know, starting with the rapture, the 7 years tribulation, the second coming, the 1,000 years, the great white throne judgment. The fact that I remember all of these is a little scarring.
That means the education worked, Pipe.
Yeah, it was really good. I don't remember our teacher's name, but he had a fantastic mustache.
of course.
And then a separate unit, we had to create a poster of the New Jerusalem. You know, because the Bible gives this description where it's like the city was X miles tall and X miles wide, and there was three gates on each side named after each of the apostles and whatever. Maybe it was tribes of Israel. I got that one wrong. And so we had to draw all this. So not only is it an end times visual representation, but it's like it requires genuine art skills to draw a 3D rendering of an imaginary city. Yeah, it was not.
Dude, it would have been hilarious to just draw a picture of like Grand Rapids. You know what I mean? There's Lake Michigan on one side, you know.
A little river running through the middle.
Dude. Yeah, yeah.
It's kind of gray and snowy. Yeah.
Pipe, was your pops, I mean, did he make a shift at some point? Like, he had to have been dispensational at some point. Am I correct in that or no?
I mean, he grew up Southern Baptist, and I think that means you're like default. I think it means you're default Arminian and default dispensational. Like, just you have to be. My dad has never spoken at length about eschatology with me, other than to say, yeah, that there's no evidence of that in Scripture about certain things. He just, I mean, it's not that he doesn't pay attention to it. It's just he has never.
It's never been a big thing.
Never put it front and center. And I do remember when I was in college, I had a professor who was very dispensational, and we had to do an expository paper on an Old Testament text. He was my OT survey prof, and I picked it was out of one of the minor prophets, and you know it was one of the passages about, you know, and there shall be fruit on the vine and et cetera, et cetera. The people shall return, and I equated it to the promise of the coming kingdom of Christ. And he gave me like a C- because that's not how a dispensational interpretation of that would be. And I was griping to my dad about this, and he quietly on the phone goes, I don't understand how anybody can be a dispensationalist and call themselves a scholar.
Wow.
and I've just held fast to those words for the last 20 years. It's, they've given me great comfort.
So him and Johnny Mac, they would have had a little, had a little disagreement on some things there. I like that.
Yeah, you know, they've had some disagreements on a few things over the years. You know, just general appreciation for each other's biblical rigor. But yeah, not totally seeing eye to eye.
Yeah, I think like T, I would love to hear your take on this, because this was just like, so my parents were saved into that tradition, Calvary Chapel, mid 70s. So for them, hearing about these things, like that was all they knew that there was. Like there sure. literally wasn't another like end times position. That's just yeah. what the Bible clearly taught, right? Kind of a thing. And so, but it's funny that in that tradition, and you know, if you were in Calvary Chapels like I was, I mean, for people that know that there are other end times positions, like they think those other positions are like heretical. Like they don't think that they're valid. I mean, they would even go so far as to, not everybody, so I don't want to go too far with this, but you would think that maybe there's a chance that somebody with a different end times position might not even, you know, be genuinely saved, right? That's how seriously it's taken and kept.
Big.
Right?
Yeah.
Big, yeah.
So I think with, like, when our parents were kids and so my parents both became believers like in high school, you know, because of like a youth group thing, essentially. I think that was kind of the only perspective. So mm-hmm. I've seen my parents kind of travel this road of, I would say they were like light dispensationalists, and now, you know, later in adulthood, they've kind of come around to Reformed theology. Whereas I feel like when we were young adults, Reformed theology was just kind of starting to pop and be cool. And we sort of got onboarded to it at, you know, at a more formative time in our lives, maybe. But yeah, for them, I think the whole rapture deal was kind of a bit of a thing. And I remember being in high school youth group, you know, early on, I would have been like a freshman, and they screened like Thief in the Night for us. Like I remember watching it and just thinking, on one level, this is the wackiest thing I've ever seen. But on another level, thinking, I'm supposed to be scared of it. So maybe I'm a little scared of it. You know, I was kind of talking myself into it, because I knew that was what I was supposed to do. And even then, I knew like the production values were bad. And I was like,
that's a very gentle take. The production.
Yeah. How can I believe something that's so crappily made, you know? But it's funny, Piper, back to your reflection on that assignment in Christian school, where with all the drawing and the timeline, that must have been Apex Mountain for a certain kind of weirdo kid that was always drawing like the Metallica album covers in his notebook. He must have just loved that assignment. You know what I mean? You get to draw like three-headed demons and go have some fun with it. You know,
yeah, he was the same kid who, when we had to do a visual rendering of the tabernacle, took great pains on the altar and the sacrifices. He's like, look, there's four goats and three bulls and a turtle dove. Dead.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, dead. All dead. 100% dead. No, that's amazing. I would have loved to have been around for like the pitch meeting of that movie. You know what I mean? So like here's what I'm thinking, guys. Stay with me. You know, a little coffee pot. We're going to have a guillotine, you know, some people in white robes, and the guys around the table being like, yeah, 100%. I'm in, I'm investing.
How can we invest the $4,000 it's going to take to make?
Yeah, dude, let me make some calls. Let me see if I can get the $4,000 together and, you know, we'll make this thing a reality. Amazing that whole motif had the legs that it had, you know what I mean? And that nobody was crying BS like sooner, you know.
Well, not in those circles. So here's what's funny, man. It's like, what's crazy is that every once in a while I get wind of, you know, or you'll be in a context where you'll realize no, those circles are very much there and in some ways intact. Yeah. And so it's just that I'm not in it anymore. So it's hard for me to fathom. I mean, I remember my pastor, this was couple decades ago, the guy that kind of introduced me to Reformed theology, you know, this guy, right? Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point, and I had come out of a Calvary chapel, and he said, man, he goes, do people still believe all that stuff? And I said, you're joking, right? I said, mm-hmm. Let me just tell you about like the churches I came out of, like they fully embrace that and believe it. And this would have been when, you know, Left Behind was still a thing and all that, the books are being written and all that stuff. But but it's like he was so out of it that it was hard for him to even fathom that anybody still was still, you know, kind of buying into that particular, you know, doctrinal perspective, you know. It's just funny.
I looked up A Thief in the Night just so we can get a few key facts on this. Released in 1972, any guesses on the production budget for this film? Speaking of great production values.
Ronald, give your best guess, and then I'll throw one out there.
Okay, so 1972, I don't know. I'm going to be a little generous. I'm going to say, like, what, $25,000?
I was higher than that.
I was going
to... Oh, higher than...
Okay. Yeah.
Dude, okay, I'm going to say no higher than 50.
It was 68,000.
Okay. Wow, you got close to that's
interesting.
But in its first decade of release, it brought in $4.2 million. So that's a pretty good ROI, as they say.
Yeah, that's a smash hit.
Directed by Donald Thompson.
Oh, Donnie! What?
It had Donald Thompson's fingerprints.
It literally
over it.
Had.
I mean, if you're familiar with his work, you know.
Man. Yeah. Don is a legend.
He's a legend.
You know that.
Yeah.
So
in Rapture movie circles, and just a wonderful guy too, a lovely person.
Oh, Don's a
if you've ever worked with Donald.
I remember I worked with Don on the post-apocalyptic movie from the late 80s. We've all worked with Don. All
just
of us
a stand-up guy. Him. Here's the elephant in the room, boys, is the fact that we're making like $250 having ha-has at the expense of these pieces of media that have literally been dumping buckets of millions onto the people that made them. That's what I struggle with. So, you know, the fact that Thief in the Night was a terrible movie that they made for $68,000 that to this day is probably like an annuity for those people. Mm. And here we are flogging away on the radio, you know, living on a prayer over here.
We haven't even hit the 3 million mark yet on the rant. So, I mean,
we got a few
percentage points to get up.
It's a slow burn. You know, it's a slow burn, the happy rant. But yeah, like, why do you think, and I don't know, we could drive ourselves crazy asking this question and trying to answer it, but I want to hear you guys briefly on it. And then I want to throw out another wacky teaching from our childhoods. But why do you think, like, that stuff did so well? Because the movie was trash. Those books are trash, quantifiably, but yet they resonated with so many people, especially the books. Like, I mean, there were probably 15 books in that series. And, you know, you got like 25 pages into the first one, and you're like, this is utterly ridiculous and bad writing. But yet, how did they do so well? Like, these are the kinds of things that keep me up at night. I can't get there.
I think at some point it becomes like a vicious circle that sort of feeds itself. But there's something about, and we talked about this at length, when something is labeled Christian, so Christian entertainment of any kind, it gets a free pass on quality. Historically, especially in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. I feel like in the last 10 to 15 years, that started to shift a little bit, at least in... you know, in certain spheres,
certain circles. Yeah.
But, and then the other thing is so that there's that aspect of it, but then there's also the, like, everybody in, like, every parent and every youth minister and every, you know, kids minister is just looking for stuff that they can safely throw at kids. Here, read this. Here, watch this. You know, like, I remember when I was in high school youth group, anytime they wanted to do, you know, we're going to do a lock-in or a movie night or whatever, there was always a debate about what movies we could watch. It could never be anything rated above PG. And even the PG movies, they couldn't say certain words, you know, an actress couldn't be wearing anything that was too, you know, revealing, et cetera. Right. And so we ended up just watching like The Princess Bride and What About Bob on repeat.
Dude, solid.
Both great movies, by the way, but just,
they are. Yeah.
Just not when they're the only movies. And
what
so,
about Bob? Ahead of its time on the whole mental health thing, too.
Yeah, I mean, and really smartly done. Probably more so than I would have appreciated at 15.
For sure.
But if you just say, oh, this is a Christian movie, like, oh, cool. We can just throw this at you. So who are the brothers who have done all of the Christian movies in the last like 15 years? Why am I forgetting their names?
Safdie Brothers. I'm just kidding. Different kinds of movies.
No, it'll come to me. They did like Courageous and all of those movies.
The Miser Brothers.
Yeah, whatever.
Snow and Heat Miser. Yeah.
I think they're out of Georgia somewhere. But like those movies, again, not good movies, but they're Christian and they're positive and they're encouraging. And so like, whatever, we'll just throw them at the kids. So I think that's a piece of it is like, and then once something catches fire inside the very dry tinder box of, you know, the Christian echo chamber, it just spreads.
No, you make a great point, Pipe. And I think it's the fact that literally when we were growing up, it just came down to hours to fill. You know what I mean? Like youth group goes 2 hours. We have it every weekend. Like, you know, those hours have got to get filled up with something. So if you can,
and you can't expect a youth pastor to like teach the Bible every week.
Oh no, gosh, no. That's not happening. Speaking of that, that reminds me of another wacky teaching that, even in my like pubescent 14-year-old mind, it didn't quite make sense to me, which was, and again, this isn't to shade the church that I grew up in or the youth pastor, if he's even listening, but, their teaching on lust was as follows. The first look is free, but the second one will cost you.
Oh, that's, I remember that one.
And I was just like, yes, even at 14, I was kind of like, huh.
So I can have one look. Huh.
Yeah, I can have one look. Can it go a long time? You know, like,
what if I only have one look?
If I don't break eye contact.
What if I only have one look, but it lasts like a day and a half? You know, I was like, huh, that seems really strange. There's no mention of like fighting that with faith or like, you know, looking to Christ to, you know, to satisfy you or whatever. It was, very, very interesting teaching on lust.
It's so funny that like it's so funny that in your, whatever it was, like your 13, 14-year-old mind, there was something you were breaking down theologically that wasn't making any sense.
Dude,
to you.
And I didn't even know I was breaking it down theologically.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. I was just like, huh, this seems lazy to me somehow.
But also, you weren't going to complain too loud because first look free, right? You know? So
Hey, the first look's free, that's something, you know?
You know what? At 17, you're going to take what you can get.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I feel like my favorite teaching as it pertained to lust was the incongruity of like, there was the, now, you know, all people are created in the image of God and like men are not more sexual sinners than women. You know, they're not worse, but also men are dogs. Like all of you young men, absolute beasts. You're just, you're not in control of your lusts or your instincts. But also, all people created in the image of God, equal as sinners, but men, you're just pigs. And, you know, just every you know, again, we're back to speciesism like we talked about a couple weeks ago. It's very insulting to the animals to compare them to young men.
That sent some red flags up for me.
I missed the speciesism. I was always confused by how we could be equal as sinners to all of the young ladies, but we were dogs, and apparently they were inherently virtuous. I never could get my head all the way around that one.
The people that thought that didn't go to my high school. I'll tell you that.
What, that the women were virtuous?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Just remember, boys, cause I was told this, I think 209 times, men give love for sex, but women give sex for love.
Oh yeah. There you go.
That was literally a mantra like for me growing up, like
just sound teaching, you know, just solid as the day is long.
Just remember that, man. Remember that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, how that wasn't in Proverbs. I don't know, you know, didn't make the cut, but, nevertheless,
at any point in your upbringing, like say prior to, I don't know, 25, did you get any actual helpful teaching on, gender, sexuality, lust, or was it all just tropes?
Absolutely not.
No, 100% no. 100%.
Yeah, it was all trash. Yeah, for sure.
What a disaster.
It was all completely unhelpful. It wasn't even mildly sexist. It was completely sexist. It wasn't able to make any, I mean, it brought in no like theology. It brought in like no helpful theology on gender And, you know, all of these like important like principles and truths that we, you know, are pretty clear in scripture, but we're slightly ignored because, again, man, the church is just, especially for teenagers, if your youth group was like my youth group, I mean, the emphasis was just, hey, man, keep your hands to yourself and do everything you can to fight like the mind games that the culture is playing, you know, with your mind and heart, that's kind of like steering you into the bedroom to do things with your girlfriend that you're not supposed to do. But there was no, man, there was no sense of like what you just said, T. There was no sense of like Christ and grace and mercy and how it is that what's how our hearts are supposed to be being conditioned through all of this. None of that was talked about. It was just, hey, you probably had a bad week. And if you have too many bad weeks, here's what's really going on. You know what I mean? At the end of the day. And yeah. It was just massively unhelpful. And you didn't see a lot of fruit or growth in either yourself or your peers through any of this stuff, right?
Just a big swing and a miss for about three decades. But you know what? It was the 80s. They were trying to build like gymnasiums and auditoriums and stuff in the church. And
well, we had to have those gyms. We needed that.
They were busy with blueprints. They were doing the thing where they like put the coffee mug on like one edge of the blueprint and then roll it out. And they're like, yeah, here's where the food court's going to go and the gym. And
but
it's going to be amazing.
It really did. But once the coffee shop went in the church, which was a great step because that allowed for a meeting place for the fruitless accountability groups where all of the men would show up and announce that they are still a dog who is still lusting and looking at porn. Let's do it again next week. And just keep meeting in that same coffee shop.
Piper, I have a new accountability group on speciesism where we just get together and we talk about
all the ways you've shamed animals.
I want to invite you to it because I feel like you're still struggling with this.
Yeah, I feel like Pipe has been struggling with that for a long time.
Man, I don't even think I'm at the point of struggle. Okay. Like I'm just having my eyes opened to the amount of damage I've done to poor little animals elsewhere.
Pipe, I want you to know that being a speciesist is at some level it's every man's battle. Okay. So you're not unique in that. And the group is going to be a nice warm, you know, kind of place to just bring some of that into the light for you.
So I want you to receive this as an intervention right now.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, Ron and I have been planning this for a long time, actually.
So here we are.
Yeah. I receive that. I'm sure I have many, many miles to go before I'm fully matured in this area. However, I could use some positive direction. So if I'm not to use speciesist terms for, you know, men's sexual proclivities, for example, what's a good alternative?
I have one for you.
Okay.
I have one. And here's the answer to the problem of speciesism for you. Mm-hmm. And it's actually going to bring us back to kind of the original topic of what we were talking about on the show today. And I think the cure, and this was the cure for every problem that I had in 1980s Christian youth culture. And it's this, Pipe, and I suggest it for you. Stop listening to secular music. If you can just burn your iPhone, just get rid of secular music. I think that is the answer, man. That is the answer.
That's just a good word. And
what about music by, so it's not Christian music, but it's by musicians who are Christians. They would like that distinction.
I just want to know right now why you feel the need to ask that question and not just burn your Spotify.
Exactly.
Yes. Okay.
All that speciesist content on Spotify.
I will burn my internet connection shortly.
I would like to do that. Yeah.
Ron, it's funny you mentioned that, and I want to ask Pipe if Wheaton College was the same way, because in the 90s when I went to college, you know, it was right kind of on that tail end of Christian music's bad, and secular music's bad. It's the source of all your problems. And like once a semester, somebody would mention something about that in chapel, and then there would be this huge, like there'd be all these flyers for people selling their CD collections. Like, I felt convicted about chapel. I'm getting rid of all my Metallica records and, you know, all my, like, Public Enemy tapes or whatever. And it would just be this treasure trove of amazing music that could be yours for, like, pennies on the dollar. Yeah. And so that was a part of the life cycle of Taylor. I think a couple times a year that would happen.
How many records did you get out of that for, like, 15 bucks?
Oh, dude, tons. I literally built my collection. It was better than like BMG. It was better than that thing where you send in a penny and they ship you like 15 CDs.
Well, T, you know what's crazy about that was like, that was, I mean, totally same experience, but our thing was taken to the point to where it was like, it was more like a burning of the music because you don't want to sell it to somebody
else. You don't want
else.
Anybody else.
Right.
Yeah, and see the Taylor kids were such lovers of money that I think they couldn't like, you know, stomach the thought of you know, that investment just going south. So they had to get something out of it.
But so did this happen? So you got this dude that has like $2,000 worth of like all of his records he's not supposed to listen to. He burns it all. And then like a month later, he's dropped like another $1,200 just to rebuy half the stuff that he had.
Well, totally. Yeah, totally. The conviction wore off.
The conviction wore off, right.
And yeah, he was back at Music Land, you know, getting restocked with all those
dude,
records.
Music Land and Sam Goody, I mean, that was the happiest.
Incredible.
Christianity's the happiest thing that ever happened to their business.
Well, absolutely, yeah, because you have people rebuying the same records every like year and a half. It was unbelievable.
Gee, Sammy, you've bought that Metallica Black album, I think, 7 times now. Do you just
like
that record? Or, oh no, I just keep burning it and then rebuying it. Oh, really? Why?
Well, he keeps rededicating his life to Christ at summer camp, burning his albums,
by
October he needs it again.
Dude, so I just hung my hat on the fact that like Metallica had a song about Passover one time, and that was my like free, you know, pass into liking Metallica without, you know, any bearing.
Guys, I have an appetite for destruction. I burn my CDs.
Yeah, literally. Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh my gosh.
Have to say, I never felt any pressure or conviction to get rid of my secular music at any point.
I think you were you came a little after that. Pipe. Yeah. I think you're young enough to where that had.
I don't think it was quite as much of a thing. Yeah. No, like Keith Green's influence had worn off a bit.
For sure.
On some of that stuff. And like my parents just weren't into music. And so they never were swayed that way where they felt very strongly we should be listening to one thing and not another. And so, yeah, I managed to avoid that.
Let me ask you this, man. Was it like, okay, so that's curious to me because I think we're getting into denominational like emphasis.
Oh, I'm sure.
Like that was talked about literally. It was almost like eschatology, man. It was talked about constantly at the churches I grew up in. So I'm just wondering because you were like, you know, Minnesota Southern Baptist, was it just not part of the discussion? They were just talking about other stuff.
Yeah, well, and also unique to our church, like I grew up Baptist General Conference, which is just, yeah, it's like, it's kind of center cut Baptist. We had this huge array of theological, convictions within the denomination. And like our church was just, we leaned very reformed, obviously, with my dad as the pastor. And there just wasn't a lot of overt legalism. With the exception of sexuality, like that was one where where it was pretty aggressively taught. Like they did a whole teaching unit on I Kiss Dating Goodbye when that came out, for example.
Nice.
But
that turned out well for everybody.
Yeah, it was really, really good. Yeah. So glad to see how that narrative arc went. But yeah, so I think we just avoided a lot of that. Now, the one thing that we did have in common with like every other Baptist tradition was during retreats and camps. It was like a little mini revival every time. You know, I think I got saved 14 times, you know.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
I only got baptized once, but saved multiple times. And
yeah, dude, you're hitting that stage and you know, walking up there and
doing the truly pipe, you're probably due again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't definitely. I mean, I don't know. I got ordained in January. Does that count for any additional amount of time? Or like do I need to rededicate soon?
I mean, dude, the Pharisees were ordained. Let's be careful.
That's a good point. It's a very good point. I'll have to, I'll have to get a phylactery or something like that and just go from there.
I love it. Well, boys, we have done what we always do in this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout some wacky teachings from our childhood. And we have a Patreon app to do. So I'm going to wrap this one and get us into that one. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
A powerful prayer life does not require hiking a mountain to be able to hear from God. God can meet us right in the middle of our busy lives to help, guide, and speak to us through prayer. I'm Christina Patterson, host of the Teach Us to Pray podcast, providing practical teaching and encouragement on how you can make prayer a natural and consistent part of your everyday life. I promise it won't require hiking a mountain, but you just might develop the faith to move one. Listen and subscribe at lifeaudio.com.